Hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of This Is My Son. I have with me yet again, almost, you know, too much.
Ubiquitously,
a guest that you're probably tired of at this point.
I'm never tired, Kathy. I could be here all night.
No. You're not tired. It's the listening public.
Listening public? Are you?
It's me.
Are you recording this?
Uh-huh.
Whoa. Yep. Whoa.
This is a podcast.
I thought we were just hanging out and being cool.
When do we do that?
Well, not often, actually.
It's true.
I've definitely never been cool with you either.
Hey, listen, I know I was cool. At least twice.
When? Cite your sources.
Remember that one time we went out and bought, like, some of those bottled Starbucks Frappuccinos and, like, a pack of cigarettes?
Oh, yeah, the mentholated cigarettes? Because we thought the mentholated cigarettes would make us more awake?
Yeah.
Oh, those
and were we could stay up and do more comedy magazine writing.
Those were so bad, those cigarettes.
Yeah, that was pretty cool. That's probably about as cool as I've gotten.
Was it more or less cool than the time we got up at 4 in the morning to meet Wes Anderson?
Well, we didn't meet him at 4 in the morning. We met him much later.
You know, in the abandoned car park when we were with Wes Anderson?
We just happened to want to wake up at, I think it was actually 3 in the morning.
Yeah, we got up at 3, arrived at 4. That's right.
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking about the time that we got a special dispensation to get into the back of the Insomnia Cookies truck.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't there for that. That was just you and Zach.
Really? No,
yeah.
You were there.
No.
It was us and Daniel Strauss.
No, you guys just sent me pictures from it. I was never there.
That's a lie.
That's okay.
That's a lie.
Okay, anyways. Listening audience, which I didn't know about till this very moment. Aren't you thrilled?
Here's another thing about the listening audience.
Yeah.
It's mostly just me while I'm editing the podcast. I'm pretty sure that's the only listener we have.
So that's nothing new then.
Yeah, so it's just I get to hear this conversation twice.
Oh, I'm so sorry. That really is like the full Max Eddie conversational experience. Yes, you get to hear this twice.
Well, usually I get to hear it several more times.
Yeah, it's a great combination of loquacious and forgetful. Gotta love it.
Max,
mm-hmm.
This week, you again, similar to the first episode of this podcast, chose both sons.
I didn't think I chose.
You absolutely did. You filled out the spreadsheet yourself.
Oh, well.
I would not have picked Volcano to go with your son.
It was just already on there. I didn't.
It was not.
I,
Max, don't lie.
Why would I put in Volcano?
I mentioned it on the episode that week as being one of my trash sons, and you filled it into the spreadsheet.
Man, I don't remember doing that.
Okay, well, it definitely happened.
Let's just say that this, much like this film, just spontaneously generated. There was no thought, no agency involved in the creation of this podcast or Volcano 1997.
That's certainly not true.
I don't know about
Anyways,
that.
It's time to talk about your son.
My son?
What is your son?
Well, my son is The Name of the Rose, the film adaptation starring Sean Connery as a German monk.
Isn't he French?
No, he's German. He's German. They're all
Isn't
German.
Isn't Baskerville in France?
I don't know. For some reason, I remember thinking that he was German.
I'm looking it up.
I read the book. Maybe I got that from the book.
Well, he had the same name in the book.
Yeah, I think they might talk about his background more in the book.
Maybe they just took Baskerville from Sherlock Holmes, and it doesn't really exist.
I think so.
Anyway, it's also a font.
He's not, let's just put it this way, he's not Scottish.
That's true. I mean, there's an ongoing theme in the show of Sean Connery playing non-Scottish characters.
Yeah,
and this is one such thing.
Yeah, gotta keep it up.
Would you like to describe the film a little bit for our listeners, probably many of whom have seen it?
Okay, so let me go all the way back, if I may. When I was a young lad growing up, we taped a lot of stuff off of TV onto VHS tapes. And we also had friends who could duplicate tapes, which was beyond our means at the time. So The Name of the Rose was one of those, either my mother taped it off of the TV or she got it as a duplicated copy, and it was also on the same VHS tape as Help, popular Beatles film, Help. And if I ever wanted to watch Help, I would have to, like, fast forward through part of The Name of the Rose. And my mom loved this movie. She was like talking about how weird and scary it was, and I would just like be, oh, I'm so fascinated by this. So that was my first exposure to it, was the thing you have to sit through to get to Help. And I can't think of like a less Help-like film.
It's like the polar opposite of Help in the movie spectrum.
Well, you know, except there is, like Ringo, there is a man suspended upside down in red fluid.
That's true.
Part of the film. So,
all right, we have a tie-in, and there's a certain amount of violence in the movie Help, also, and murderousness.
A lot of white guys playing people who are not the people they are in Help.
People playing their non-actual ethnicities.
Yeah. So the Name of the Rose is I think it's like an early 86. So the year of my birth. So this is a year zero for me. Directed by some dude. And it is based on a book by Umberto Eco.
Some French fucker, probably.
Some French dick. And or as they say, French baguette, which means penis.
I think that's true.
So it's based on a book by Umberto Eco, which I've read and is the only Umberto Eco novel I've enjoyed so far. It's very dense and pretty difficult to get through. And he, in turn, based it off of the writings of Jorge Luis Borges, who I've also come to know and love quite dearly. So it really is like an amalgam of everything I like. I also really like James Bond movies and medieval shit, and also Amadeus. N.F. Murray Abraham is in this. It's everything I love wrapped up in this movie.
Now, I might say, if I were a mom, say, of a child, I might say there are some ideas and imagery in this movie that I might find inappropriate
my
child.
Don't forget, like, the subtle pedophilia. No, don't forget
Not incredibly subtle. Nope, not very subtle at all. And definitely fairly explicit sex scene.
Isn't that horrifying? Like
that? Yeah, like a semi-rapey, weird feral woman.
Oh yeah,
just going to town on Christian Slater.
I've read in the production notes. I can't remember if I read some Wikipedia or somewhere else, but they didn't tell Christian Slater they were going to film that scene. They just sit in this hay and just see
what
happens.
Just go with it. Just go with it.
Be cool. I think for a long time, like until I saw. Like actual film pornography, like this was perhaps the most explicit. Well, until I saw another film that my mother rented, and was like, "Hey, Max, do you want to watch Last Tango in Paris?"
Oh no,
you're 13. That seems like a great idea.
Oh,
so until I saw that, this was probably the most like explicit sex scene I'd ever seen.
I mean, as far as just like standard rated R movies, it's fairly explicit.
Yeah, it really is.
I mean, there's a little sliver of Christian Slater peep in it.
Yeah, a little bit. Did you go back and like frame by frame it?
Yeah.
I could have sent you the timestamp for that, but you know, I wanted you to go on a journey of exploration.
Well, I'm sure you have all the screenshots.
Yeah, I have every frame. I just have a big folder. It's just every frame of The Name of the Rose, you know, for reference. Yeah, the movie is real gross. Like everything about the movie is real gross. It's like everything is sort of moist and drippy and covered in a patina of filth. And apparently, when they were casting the movie, like the only thing they were looking for is like find weird looking people in Europe. That was all.
Was so clear to me because it's like especially as they're introducing all of the monks at this abbey that. You know, Sean Connery and Christian Slater go
right,
to. It's
right.
Like each one is like more grotesque than the next.
And then you get to fucking Ron Perlman.
Who also, well, his grotesquery was heightened. He doesn't normally look that.
I mean.
He had some prosthetics on his face.
Are you sure that could be what he just looks like normally?
Oh, so he has corrective prosthetics and everything else.
Yeah, and that's also just the language that he speaks, that like non-language.
That sort of Spanish, sort of Latin, sort of English thing.
That weird pidgin speak that he's got. Oh, and another thing I absolutely love about this movie is that the abbot of the abbey is the guy that plays Drax in Moonraker.
Okay.
So it's just the James Bond tie-ins are all over the place.
No, if I had to pick a movie that I would feel like is about as far from James Bond as you can get while still having Sean Connery in it, right, I might select this one.
Not Zardoz.
I have not seen Zardoz.
I haven't seen Zardoz either. We should do like a joint son for that.
Should we? No, that's not how This Is My Son works. You don't just watch a movie and assume it will be your son. That is not correct.
We could call it like a trial adoption episode.
No. No. It's not how the podcast works.
All right. So
you gotta hew to the premise.
So the movie is about the MacGuffin that gets it all going is a theological debate between the Franciscan monks, which include...
It's not what a MacGuffin is.
It's the thing that gets the plot going that actually doesn't
matter. That's not what a MacGuffin is.
Oh, but it's not like a thing. Okay, so it's like a...
Oh, a MacGuffin is something that all of the characters are desperately concerned with, but that doesn't ultimately matter.
Well, I mean...
And it's true that this doesn't ultimately matter, but also most of the characters don't really seem to give a shit about it throughout most of the movie.
So really, the actual MacGuffin in this movie is Jesus.
I would say the MacGuffin is the book that they're looking for.
Yeah, that's probably true. MacGuffins don't normally murder, though, do they?
Well, it was a tool of murder. Yeah, there's certainly MacGuffins that can be dangerous.
Okay. Well, so there's this, regardless of my misuse of filmic terminology, and thank you for correcting me, the Benedictines are there, I'm sorry, the Franciscans are there to have a debate with a papal representation about whether or not Jesus owned a purse. And this all, if you read the book, and if you get into, like I did for a while, monastic orders... the Franciscans, don't own anything. They just sort of, wander around. They're mendicant. Meanwhile, the Benedictines, they actually do own stuff. I think the Benedictine order, everything is owned in common, but it's still... And this is, one of the criticisms of the book and of the film, is that the Benedictines are, covetous and have all this gold and all this stuff, but are still living in filth. And there's, the gross inequality between the way they live, which is still gross, but not nearly as gross and nasty as the people who live... at the bottom of their charity chute.
Their charity garbage chute.
Yeah, where they throw all their crap to the peasants, who also provide all their food. There's a scene lining up where all the peasants are lining up and giving them their tithes. And that's where the girl that Christian Slater, who is Sean Connery's, apprentice...
novice.
Yes, she comes from that little town down there. I like that she never speaks, and no one from the town ever speaks anything intelligible.
Yeah, I mean all of the peasantry is basically explicitly depicted as being animal-like and subhuman, basically.
Which is kind of a problem.
Yeah. Do you want to go into the problematic things? Because I found a lot of them in this movie.
Oh man, there's so many. The things I like about this movie are some of the set pieces I really like, and I also just love how atmospheric it is. Mm-hmm. The story itself and some the things that happen are pretty horrible. But I'll finish my recap real quick. So they all show up there for this debate that's supposed to happen, but Sean Connery's character kind of doesn't give a crap about that. He's way more interested in this library that's there, except no one can get into the library. And also there's been a string of mysterious murders. Well, there's been one mysterious murder followed by other mysterious murders, which they all eventually link back to, spoiler alert, a book which is written by, is it Aristotle?
Yep.
Yeah, so it's a book by Aristotle, which is a lost work. It's one of those things that actually does exist in scholarship where everyone has, criticisms of it. Everyone knows it exists, but no one has a copy of it. And this library does, and it's a treatise on using humor, and a humorous treatise as a teaching tool, and it's just, a book of funny stuff. And there's an old man in the abbey who objects to its existence, and antics ensue. In a labyrinth.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. For its strong points, definitely visually,
mm-hmm.
It's very strong. Atmospherically, it's very strong. You get a real sense of place, and granted, it's a not comfortable place to be.
No.
It's extremely disturbing. I mean, the labyrinth scene is extremely, claustrophobic and disorienting. In a good way, generally. I mean, I think it filmically is mm-hmm. very strong.
And very clever, too, because I was thinking that they probably only did that whole labyrinth with maybe, one or two sets. But
they only need really to have one room, and then they had like shots of staircases, and that's pretty much it.
And there's some good model work in there too, which is kind of surprising for a movie like this. Like, it's not like stupendous model work. It's not like a Terry Gilliam level for this time period, but it's surprising that there's like some pretty decent effects shots. Like, even the establishing shot of the Abbey on the mountaintop is completely a composite. Like, it's not real at all.
Well, I mean, that's what special effects were until the mid-90s, pretty much.
I guess I'm just surprised that there's, like, so much lavish set dressing in what is, you know, kind of a small film.
I don't think it's a small film.
You don't think so? I mean, I didn't think it made a lot of money or anything.
Well, it didn't make money, but it was a pan-European co-production.
Oh, shit, it made a lot of money.
Well, yes, internationally. It didn't make a lot of money in America.
Yeah, probably not. But it made...
But it's not a... I mean, this... They got a lot of big-name actors. Uh-huh. It's shot pretty much, like, all... It seems like a lot of it on location.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say, yeah, I mean, Christian Slater, I'm sure, in the mid-80s was a very expensive property.
Really?
Well, wasn't he in, like, teen movies and shit before that?
I have no idea about...
I'm checking in.
Okay, do it.
So, I guess he was only in two movies before this. Huh. I thought it was maybe earlier than that.
My recollection was that this was like a seminal moment for him, like his career. Like this,
seminal?
Yeah. It's like where he started, like they take him seriously after this.
Yeah, okay. So yeah, you're right. I think this was probably one of his bigger first big movies.
Yeah, I would say like probably F. Murray Abraham or Sean Connery were like the big
steals
for this. Yeah.
Although he, so... I guess maybe it was maybe more of like an introducing thing, but he got the "and" credit at the end. Or, I mean, Christian Slater got the "and" credit at the in the opening credits for it.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah, I was thinking about this in Zardoz, actually, because I think Sean Connery, like... I think Sean Connery just sometimes, like, does weird movies because he thinks they sound interesting. I don't know. Like, I just don't understand. I can't think of a good reason why someone who's at a pretty good point in their career would make a movie like The Name of the Rose.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same way a lot of sort of big name actors do, where they do, like, they make movies for money and then they make movies for fun. And that's, I would assume this is a fun end one.
And I think this is some of, I haven't seen a lot of Sean Connery movies outside of the James Bond verse, but this is some of, I think, probably some of his best acting.
Yeah.
He's like shows a range. He, like, moves between, like, being intellectually disdainful and despairing, and also just kind of like witty and joyful at times. It's, I don't know, it's fun. It's fun.
It's pretty good. It's not exactly, you know, like the most impressive acting I've ever seen, but it's for him, I would
for
say.
For him. Let's be real.
Well, he's not, you don't think of Sean Connery as like a character actor. He's a Sean Connery actor.
That's very true. That's right? Very true.
In terms of the plot and the storyline, I think it's interesting, or one thing that sort of struck me is he's basically a standard, like, great detective character.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And he's totally effective in doing his detective work, but the difference between this setting and a standard, like, 19th century great detective thing is nobody gives a shit about what what he deduces. Like, he's like, yeah, I got all my tools, I got my astrolabe, I got my, like, magnifying glasses, I'm gonna solve a mystery. And everyone else is like, yeah, fuck you. Who cares?
they sort of like pay attention to him at first, but like as the stakes are raised, I don't know if you can hear that in the background, by the way, but I think that's my radiator. It started making this like lawnmower sound recently, and I don't know what it means. I'm just gonna.
It's a little man in there.
It's a little man pedaling a bicycle. It's like the Flintstones. Like, I'm just gonna open up my radiator. There's like a little imp in there. He goes, eh, it's a living.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
That happens.
Yeah.
Every day.
Yeah. I think his character is pretty interesting because I've never understood his relationship with religion. He seems someone who is, well, his character's history suggests that he has been like injured by the establishment and has perhaps like retreated into rationalism. And in the book, he's like constantly quoting Bacon, like to the point of irritation.
Hmm.
Like, he's really big into, you know, free thought and humanism, but only really up to a point. Because at the end of it, he's still like, nah, we can deny people's humanity because intellectualism, that's where it's at, bro.
And I think that brings it back neatly back around to one of the problematic aspects, which is the lack of humanism overall in this movie.
Oh, man.
And the almost complete disdain for humanity as a concept.
Yeah.
It's basically just like, if you're not a smart free thinker, then like literally you're essentially an animal or like a goblin monster, mm-hmm. and you deserve to die probably.
Right. It's really strange because they depict the Catholic Church, mainstream Catholicism, because the Franciscans are sort of outside of that. And mm-hmm. Baskerville, Sean Connery's character, is sort of outside of them too, and they regard him as important and a good intellectual, but they don't really like him very much. He's standing apart from all these organizations which are like varying degrees of corrupt. And normally in that narrative, it's like, oh, it's the peasants, the people working the land, like the simple folk. They're the ones that are like your heroes. But no. No, they're like grotesque, disgusting monsters that...
And they're nonverbal animals, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, literally animals, and who are shown as being oppressed and exploited by the church, but are also shown to be, like, cruel and...
And they're too stupid to do anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, they have the power. At the end, they kind of rise up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they could have risen up a lot earlier than they actually did. Like, it's only once shit started to go down that they're like, oh, we're going to interrupt with this witch burning.
And it's not really clear to me that that's a good thing, because they're pretty brutal.
Well, I mean, I think the idea, though, is that at least they rescued one of their own rather than letting her die.
Mm. That is true.
Like, we don't care about the two monks who did burn alive.
They're interesting. I didn't know if you caught on that they're I can't remember how much they talk about their heresy, but they're like, mm-hmm. they are like populists. They're like, yeah, the church is bad. We should redistribute wealth and all this, but also murder people. That's
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. So I mean, there are a couple of themes from their religiosity element. One of them, one of the central ones, is the idea of comedy and humor being something that is seen as permissible from mm-hmm. a religious standpoint,
mm-hmm.
Versus the complete seriousness of the Benedictine monks.
Yeah, like their severity. Enforcing. Yeah.
Yeah, and then the other side being the poverty versus wealth, which is most clearly illustrated when the papal delegation does get there and they're in their like fancy ass cardinal outfits.
Mm-hmm.
In contrast to the Franciscans, who are basically wearing like brown sacks.
But the Franciscans aren't very good either, because they've got that they have that guy, that old dude. Oh, what's his name?
The creepy pedophile guy.
Yeah, the creepy pedophile guy, who is like, oh, he's like our most important dude, like our most important mystic. He has visions, and it's really important that we like protect him above everyone else. By the way, he's like all creeping on Christian Slater. Like,
yeah, there's also a very much lot of like multiple times in this movie where they talk about how foul, grotesque, and basically evil women are.
Yeah, constantly.
Several times, including him. While at the same time, them being like fetishized and sexualized.
So the
victim-like way.
There's a lot of commentary happening about the Catholic Church in this movie.
Uh-huh.
The thing is, they present no... Like as you said, I don't want to, steal your thunder. As you said, the only alternative to this that they present is, a sort of individualist intellectualism.
Mm-hmm.
Which is... I mean, at the end of the movie, Christian Slater is given this choice to, stay... And he has these weird fantasies of, lifting this girl out of poverty and, teaching her and caring for her. Very, paternalistic and weird. And at mm-hmm. the end of the movie, he does have that opportunity to, abandon his monastic studies and run off with her. And he instead chooses to hang out with Sean Connery until Sean Connery dies. It's a happy ending. Kind of.
Well, I mean, they do kind of say oh yeah, her face is the only one I remember. Again, yeah, and then with also the caveat, yeah, I never learned her name Because I didn't really care. I had an opportunity to ask her. I could have, like, said any whatever I felt like to her at that last moment when they sort of meet on the trail out.
Yeah.
He chose not to.
That moment is really weird, too, because she's shown to be, like, a sex worker exchanging sex for food. And and then when they meet for the second time, she's, like, kind of fawning over him in the same way that we saw her earlier. And it's also implied that, like, oh, you know, she fucked him the first time because, like, he was so beautiful. Like, he didn't need to pay.
Yeah.
It's so gross.
Yeah, I was fairly squicked out by the dehumanization of her.
Yeah.
And of women in general in the movie, of women just being like, yeah, they're just some inexplicable, monstrous, evil goblin entities. And they're like, yeah, they must have some virtues. Nah. Who knows what they are?
Otherwise, why are they here? Why would God create them?
Uh-huh.
Good job getting laid, Christian Slater, BT Dubs.
You did it.
You did it. And that, yeah, like, they don't really present, like, the people saying those things in the movie are shown to be, like, bad people, but no one ever, like, corrects those behaviors.
Well, I mean, Sean Connery even gets on the women's slamming game a little bit.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not as bad as some of the other people, but doesn't really have much good to say about them.
Yeah, and this is, it's a relentlessly bleak view of humanity. One that the book is difficult. Echo's prose is always really, really thick, and Echo's always like lost in his own references and his own cleverness.
Well, he's a postmodernist,
he's a postmodern semiotician who, yep. He died recently, and who is, like, famous for being, like, one of the, you know, 21st century's, like, foremost intellectuals. Like, he's known for being a smarty pants. And actually, what I remember most about the book is that they spend way more time figuring out the labyrinth. There's, like, an elaborate trick to the labyrinth where he, like, explains how you can navigate it, but in text.
Yeah, it sounds like thrilling prose.
Nope. I was reading, I'm sort of like, oh, this is interesting. I wonder how long this is going. Oh, boy.
Skip forward a couple chapters. It's still happening.
It's just one chapter. Just one
very long chapter.
Extensive chapter. And Borges, too. Borges has a not great relationship with women. Women very... I don't know if I've read the entirety of his fiction works, but I think I might have, actually. I think he maybe wrote one novel that I haven't read. But I've read everything else by him. And women very rarely show up. And when they do, he does not handle them well. There's a story about a woman who takes revenge on someone by faking a rape. And that's, like, the way she's able to take power in that social structure.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's really bad. And it feels like he's writing as, like, a story of empowerment. Like, these subjugated women are able to, like, strike back against the people that oppress them. But at the same time, it's like, no, not really.
Not great.
And then there's only one other story that mentions a woman directly. And it's one that's, like, weirdly... He, like, tries to write about a relationship and sex, and it's not good, because Borges is not that kind of a writer. He writes these, like, carefully constructed intellectual mystic fables, and whenever he tries to actually, like, be human, it's just weird. Weird and uncomfortable. And Borges, like, sort of appears in this movie, too. Jorgi, his full name is, like, Jorgi Berg. It's, like, cognate to Borges. It, like, rhymes with that. And like Borges, he's blind, and is the keeper of the labyrinth.
Oh, the one who ends up eating the poisoned pages at the end?
Yeah, yeah, Venerable Jorgi.
Oh, Venerable Jorgi.
Venerable Jorgi, yeah. I actually feel really guilty about having you watch this movie now.
You shouldn't feel guilty. I don't think it's not a bad film to have in your knowledge repertoire. Mm-hmm. I have one quick question.
Yeah.
If I were reading a book where one of the corners was covered in green slime, I probably wouldn't be licking my finger to turn the page. I'm no monk.
And it's like every corner too. It's not just like, oh, what's that?
It's like they dipped the entire edge of the book into green slime.
Oh man, yeah, and it's again, is very... It's such a typical Echo and Borges. I should say that I love the work of Borges, but Borges was also, like, interested in detective fiction. And he wrote... He wrote a basically a Sherlock Holmes story, which is, it's totally bizarre. And there's a really bizarre movie version of it starring the dad from Everybody Loves Raymond as like this French Zen police master.
Huh.
It's bewildering. But yeah, it's such a... It's one of those things that, like, does not hold up to... Like, the revelation to this mystery does not hold up to any sort of, like... reasonable examination. It's too clever. It's just so clever. And yeah, like, I could make this long argument, but like, oh, you know, vellum books are gross and everyone's covered in ink anyway. They wouldn't notice it. And everything is gross in this movie. Why would someone notice that? But like, nah, it's ridiculous. Like,
it doesn't, I mean, it's, this is really, it's more of a fable than a realistic story.
Yeah. I mean, the idea here is that this blind librarian, and all the metaphoric weight behind that, is taking the thing that should free the minds and like uplift humans with its knowledge, this book, and has turned it into something that by reading it kills you.
Yeah, and he himself consumes it and destroys it in the end, as well as all this other knowledge when he sort of sets his library aflame.
Yeah. Exactly. I mean, I think that's probably, like, the main... We've barely talked about it, but that's, like, the main thrust of this film. And of the story, too, is about the lost knowledge.
From a filmic perspective, if I were making it, and I think this is one of the reasons why it maybe got mixed critical reviews, is it feels too unfocused. I think it falls into the trap that a lot of adaptations of books fall into, which is that they try to cover too much of the ground that the book does, right. And they don't embrace or realize the fact that movies fundamentally need to be different. I think if they had focused it, like taken out even like the papal delegation and a lot of other stuff, and just focused it around the books and the murder investigation detective stuff, it could have been a much more cohesive and much more engaging movie.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there's not very many like the actual debate that the whole like plot is supposed to be.
Yeah, there's only like 2 minutes given to it.
it's barely present. And I think they actually Hugh Beringer, is that his name? No, I might be mixing this up. I get this confused with Cadfile a lot of the time. Oh, Bernardo Gui.
Inquisitor.
Yeah, F. Murray Abraham's character, yeah. Bernardo Gui, shows up. And I can't remember if he's not in the book or if he's just like his character is greatly expanded in the
movie. I think he is in the book because I was reading the Wikipedia page. Okay. For
yeah,
it.
I think just his character is greatly expanded. I think his death is different in like a very dramatic way. So they kind of like built that character out more for the movie.
And even so, he doesn't really show up until pretty close to the end.
Yeah, like 20 or 30 minutes away from the end. And his like the role that he plays, he raises the stakes, certainly. Mm-hmm. He definitely like adds to the tension, and some of the courtroom stuff with him and Baskerville is like entertaining and interesting.
But I think it needed a lot more screen time though than it got.
Yeah, like I almost say like you could maybe cut that out or maybe tie it in a little bit closer because I'm sort of struggling. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, maybe if they had made that court case about the books rather than being about this like totally faked out like witchcraft thing, like it's like there's a bunch of murders happening, probably the Inquisitor, maybe we should have the Inquisitor do an investigation of the murders rather than there's a witch doing witchcraft.
I mean he does like he just shows up and is like, oh, I see that you have like some black magic bullshit going on here, that is the cause of your murders, and like it's just another like layer of anti-intellectualism that Baskerville struggles against that, like, it does, it reinforces the themes of the film, but I don't think it really, like, advances anything, really.
Yeah, I don't know, it feels like too little too late. If they'd stretched it out a little bit more, I think it might have heightened it. If maybe they'd compacted the murders to happen in a quicker succession.
Mm-hmm. Or if they even just, like, kicked it off with, like, this Bernardo Gui is here.
Yeah.
Look out.
We've had a murder, and we've got an inquisitor here, and now you have to investigate while he's also investigating.
Yeah.
And then it's going to end in a trial. Let's just rewrite the movie and remake it.
And that would be such like a classic, private detective. Like, keep your nose out of church business, Baskerville.
Uh-huh. Like, he would just play the policeman role.
Exactly. Flatfoot. Yeah. So, it's not... It is... far from a perfect film. I'm you seem to have enjoyed at least some aspects of it, so I'm grateful.
Well, you know, I love creepy shit.
It is really creepy.
I do like monks, and I do like the Middle Ages, and I like creepy religious shit.
Yeah.
So I liked it in that sense.
I mean, the thing is, like, I keep coming back to this movie because I have never seen another feature-length film that... Like, I hesitate to say, the amateur medievalist in me is like, this is not an accurate portrayal of the period.
The Middle Ages.
Not at all. Like, it is a, as you would say, it is a heightened reality. It is a grotesque of a grotesque.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, whenever the medieval period is usually in film, it's usually in the context of fantasy. And there's not really a lot of,
or
like,
military stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I can't really point to like a lot of, like, besides the Pillars of the Earth. I can't really think of like a...
Well, Shakespearean movie adaptations are usually pretty good for their historical.
Sure,
like, watch,
but
like Henry V or something.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But yeah, a lot of the... I mean, I guess I'm thinking like a lot of those I've seen have been like really stylized, like Ian McKellen's Richard III, like. That's usually how I've engaged with those. But
well, his Ian McKellen's Richard III, isn't it set in like Nazi era?
He's
it's
basically
not even
a
set
Nazi
in the past.
But that's what I mean. Is like they'll take stories from the period that are set in the period and like stylize them and change them around so that it's different. But I end up coming back to this movie because there's not like a lot of other places for me to go to get that kind of like weird, spooky medieval experience. And it's got so many set pieces that I just love, like the bizarre labyrinth and like the monastery itself is just such a cool setting. I don't know. Mm. If you like that kind of stuff but want to see less gross shit, the other thing I come back to from time to time are the BBC TV adaptations of Cadfael, starring what's his name?
Clavdivs.
No, it's oh no, this is so
I guarantee bad. You they're starring Clavdivs.
gotta kill time while I look up who plays him because it's so absurd. Shit. Derek Jacobi. Derek.
Yes, Clavdivs.
Yeah. Yeah, Clavdivs.
Do not like
Oh,
Clavdivs.
Sorry.
I Clavdivs.
Oh my god. I'm sorry. I thought you were just making a playoff of Cadfael.
No, fuck you.
Oh my god. Oh, I'm an idiot. Yeah, it's Clavdivs.
Clavdivs.
Clavdivs. Clavdivs.
No, no.
Clavdivs.
Because on the cover of the VHS that you get from the library,
uh-huh.
It's in Roman style, so the U's all look like V's.
Uh-huh.
It's I Clavdivs.
Clavdivs. So Derek Jacobi is in this as a retired, almost as absurd as Sean Connery playing a monk is Jacobi, very monkish, but he's like a retired, crusader. Because when you think of Derek Jacobi, like, this looks like a dude that's probably killed a lot of people.
He's probably slaughtered a bunch of Muslims.
He's probably like real big and strapping and like knows his way around a sword.
Well, retired.
I mean, it's Derek Jacobi. He's like this...
Yeah, he's a nerd. He looks like a nerd.
He's basically playing like the same character as Connery, which is like, oh, I'm religious, but I also like have this big humanist streak, and I'm into like herbs and science and natural science and shit like that. And it's very much in that same vein, but significantly less gross, and I think probably a lot more historically accurate.
Yeah.
So yeah, those are fun. The books are good too, but you know, not a lot of labyrinths, not nearly enough labyrinths.
Well, let's rate it.
Okay. Well, how many labyrinths are how many labyrinths of lost knowledge are you going to give this movie?
Labyrinths of lost knowledge is a pretty big unit.
Yeah, I know.
Like yesterday, we were doing not yesterday. Last week we did
no,
chili
yesterday.
Dogs.
We did it. Did it yesterday.
Yesterday, can I give chili dogs again? No, okay. Here's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
I'm going to rate it on a scale of 1 to 5 slimy poison books.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Which is, it has to be a unit you can at least sort of wrap your head around. I think Labyrinth is a little too.
Slimy poison books or weird, pale, squishy, bald men.
Weird, pale, twisted, gross, bald men.
Didn't you just love that guy who never speaks?
Oh, God, that guy grossed me out so much.
Yeah, that's another one. It's like, oh yeah, so like the one that everyone's like, oh yeah, he's totally committing crimes against nature, and by that I mean gay stuff. It's like he's one of the most unpleasant looking people in this movie.
Yeah, there's a lot of problematic shit going.
Oh, I know.
Like, okay, anyway. Name of the Rose. I'm going to give it 2.5 slimy poison books.
Harsh, but fair.
It's harsh but fair. I think I might like the book more than I would like the movie. I think the movie has its ups and downs, or it has mostly downs, but it's got some ups. And I did enjoy parts of it, and I thought the imagery was good, but I found the story so unpleasant and abhorrent in a lot of ways.
Yep.
I would much rather be watching Help, to be honest. A fun and carefree movie.
A fun and carefree, casually racist movie.
It was the 60s.
Yeah.
And English people didn't really know about racism back then.
They invented it, so they didn't know it was happening.
Well,
was
and they were all very into being racist against Indians in particular.
Oh yeah.
Anyways.
Such a weird movie.
Let's not even touch that yet, because who knows if that's gonna be a future son.
Boy, the thing is though, if you want to talk about race, here comes Volcano.
Hey, Volcano addresses race head on and it fixes the problem. Yes, we're here in the second half of This Is My Son.
Oh boy.
And the son which Max selected for me because I mentioned it in passing is...
I'm not taking responsibility for having to watch Volcano.
You absolutely need to.
I don't remember doing this.
Okay. Well, maybe you did it well in a drunken haze.
In a fugue. I went into a fugue.
A fugue state and typed the name Volcano into a spreadsheet.
I just wrote the first word that came to mind, and it just happened to be 1997's Volcano.
And this is a movie that...
It sure is.
It's definitely a movie that is one of the... I would say probably my dad's probably top 10 movies that's in there. In that he just frequency of him watching it. So I've seen it a lot. And the number of times I've seen it, and also probably the fact that when it came out, the hot, hot year of 1997, it was like immediately after Dante's Peak came out. And it was basically, you know, volcanoes were the cool thing that year. Mm-hmm. And they were hot. By which I mean very hot. It's volcanoes.
I'm looking at one of the posters for Volcano, and the tagline is, it's hotter than hell.
It's true. Or the same heat. I don't know how hot hell is.
I mean, I would say it's about probably the same.
So I have both, as a child, you know, I was super into things that, like, every child in the 90s thought were the coolest. So, like, volcanoes, dinosaurs,
Tommy Lee Jones,
like, lots of details about the Titanic disaster.
Yeah. Oh,
things, man, that every child loved.
I mean, you really, like, Bob Ballard was my hero, so.
Yeah, shit. So, anyways, and Volcano was, you know, came out of that time, was probably, you know, one of the first PG-13 movies that I saw in theaters, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it many times subsequently, probably too many for me to be super aware of whether or not it's a good movie anymore, because I know it very well. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The premise of this film, in case you are not aware of it, or you're someone who's a despicable human being who prefers or has only seen Dante's Peak, the premise of this movie is that, one, the La Brea Tar Pits are actually volcanic, which they're not, and two, a volcano erupts in the middle of Los Angeles, downtown Los Angeles.
And can I interject quickly here? MacArthur Park plays a critical role in this film, and at no point, even when there's lava spewing out of it, at no point does anyone say MacArthur's Park is melting down, which is just a shameful missed opportunity to make a reference to my favorite song, Someone Left the Cake Out in the Rain.
So that's a little bit of a divergence. from the topic?
I don't think so at all.
You didn't understand what the cake was.
Can you please? That cake was Kennedy. Can you please, when you edit this, can like the ending sting just be the chorus of "Someone Left the Cake Out in the Rain," as performed by the original Dumbledore?
Maybe.
Okay, tell me more about Volcano, Kathy.
Volcano is the story of a dad named Tommy Lee Jones who has to save all the whole city of Los Angeles.
He has a very pronounceable name, like Rourke. Rourke.
His name is literally the sound of masculinity.
The masculinity leaving a large dog.
Uh-huh.
Rourke. Rourke.
He does this with the help of a lesbian geologist, mm-hmm. played by Anne Hesh. Mm-hmm. And does it, and Don Cheadle, his buddy, who works at the same like disaster zone.
I was so excited when disaster office. I saw that Don Cheadle was in this movie. I was like, oh, thank God! Like,
he really raised the game.
He really does.
Yeah, I mean, brought a lot of personality, and I think you know Tommy Lee Jones and Anne Hesh do a good job, mm-hmm. As well as you know Marge's husband, sorry, from Fargo, who does a good job and then melts.
There's so many characters in this movie.
Yeah, it's got a good number. And I actually just read a criticism on the Wikipedia page that it didn't have enough characters.
Are they fucking kidding me?
Like, there's plenty of characters in this movie.
There was Asian Doctor, and she has, like, this whole subplot for some reason.
Yeah, like, where she's, like, got, like, this her fiancé who she becomes disillusioned with. Like, yeah. That...
He's played by someone famous, right? Like, I don't know. Who that's a guy?
He's a professional dickhead.
Who is that guy?
I don't know. Probably a 90s TV actor.
Is it John Corbett?
I don't know.
Maybe?
Who cares? Who gives a shit? Volcano.
Oh, man.
Anyways, then, so Volcano erupts.
It's John Corbett from Northern Exposure.
Oh, okay. Was he the main character in Northern Exposure?
No. He's Carrie Bradshaw's girlfriend on Northern Exposure.
Carrie Bradshaw's girlfriend on Northern Exposure.
Oh, he's the male lead in My Big Fat Greek Wedding. That's why he looks
so
familiar.
That guy.
Yeah.
He's also
done voiceovers for Applebee's and Walgreens ads.
The very key thing about him in this movie is his beautiful giant penis building gets destroyed.
Isn't it really important that they establish that too? Like, they couldn't just be like, there's a building, let's blow that up.
No,
like,
it's very specifically this asshole's building.
We really need to establish. Can you just imagine the story meeting for this? And someone's like, but what's the story behind the building that we're going to blow up in this special effects sequence?
An asshole built it.
An asshole built it and tries to woo his girlfriend. What if we made that girlfriend a kind of a character in this movie?
She has a pretty extensive part for a disaster movie. I mean, you get a little bit of character development along with the fact she's just basically the doctor helping all the injured, burned people.
She is literally the only character arc in the movie.
Like, I was actually arguing about this with my parents this morning.
Oh man, do it. Let's hear it.
I think that none of the main characters have arcs particularly. They don't, mm-hmm. like Tommy Lee Jones doesn't change. Anne Hesh doesn't change.
Well, he learns to take a vacation. He learns to like, I've already saved you from one volcano. I am not interested in helping out.
But you know, if there are a second volcano erupted, he would totally be there helping out. He just doesn't want to do the cleanup after.
Oh my God. The ending to it is like, wow, the hero is such a dick. Like Don Cheadle comes up and is like, we have so many problems to solve, and he's like, nah, I'm done.
No, because the Don Cheadle's plot was that he really wants to be Rourke and have Rourke's job. Like, so in the beginning, he's like sitting at Rourke.
Rourke?
Tommy Lee Jones.
Okay.
You know, at the beginning, when Tommy Lee Jones is supposed to be on vacation, he mm-hmm. comes into the office, and right. Don Cheadle's sitting at his desk with his feet up on it. So it's pretty much depicted throughout that he wants that job. Don Cheadle wants that job.
Yeah,
and he gives it. He basically gets it at the end.
It's surprising that they don't get married at the end. There's so much tension there. I really thought that, like, that's where that was going to go.
What, Don Cheadle and Tommy Lee Jones?
Yeah, because, like, you know, Tommy Lee Jones has that, like, harpy wife that hangs up on him and is horrible.
Well, she's an ex-wife. Never seen.
His ex-wife. Yeah, he's available for Don Cheadle.
Yeah, I mean, but I don't think it's ruled out in the canon that they get together. Like, they totally could.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
I mean, I think the key thing, the most important thing to me, is that there isn't any overt romantic resolution with Anne Hesh.
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually because, well, first off, I was trying to remember who that was, and she was in 6 Days, 7 Nights, right? With Harrison Ford?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, another, like, that's a good movie that also does not have like a lot of romantic. Oh, maybe is she romantically involved with Harrison Ford?
I'm pretty sure she is.
Maybe. Never mind. It's a good movie though. I remember being surprised by 6 Days, Seven Nights. Like, oh, this is enjoyable. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of like moon eyes at each other. And it was weird that, like, she gets kind of sidelined towards the end of the movie. It's like, go find my daughter.
Like, that's she's not given a ton to do. And at the end, the main problematic point, I think, actually, is the daughter in general.
Yeah.
Because she is pretty much, except for, like, she becomes, like, all of a sudden super competent when she's taking care of these little kids.
Mm-hmm.
But still before that and after that, she's essentially just like can do nothing but stand around impotently screaming.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like 13. She would be able to figure out how to keep herself safe. Like at the end when there's a building falling down on her, Tommy Lee Jones is slow motion running. I don't know what he's going to accomplish because apparently all he does is tackle her and the children she's with, but somehow saves their life that way. But like she has at least like 30 seconds to be running away.
Yeah, and of course Anne Hesh like spots Tommy Lee Jones like across like 200 yards.
Well, he runs like fucking a football field or more over the course of like a half second to go and tackle his daughter.
Okay, we should back up. Kathy, I want you to give me the Cliff's Notes to Volcano, Rourke's big adventure, Rourke's big day out.
Rourke's big day out is that he's supposed to be on vacation hanging out with his daughter, mm-hmm. Daughter of his divorced former marriage.
And is she a surly teen?
She is a surly teen. She wants to get a nose piercing.
Right.
It's depicted that she wants to get a nose piercing, so we know that she's a teen and she is not manageable because she's a rebellious girl. And he doesn't really get her because he's just a dad.
Yeah. He's just a dad in Los Angeles.
So they're waking up in the morning on their big vacation day. They're going to have a good time and hang out and either go down to the mall or he wants to take her to Disney World because he thinks she's still just daddy's little girl. But then there's an earthquake and because his job is emergency man.
Emergency man.
He goes into the emergency office where they check on the emergencies and they're like, no, it's just an earthquake. It's Los Angeles. It's fine. And it's established that you came from St. Louis where they don't have earthquakes, it's just floods.
But they do compliment his Midwestern work ethic for coming to work to do his job at all.
Yes. Well, when he's supposed to be on vacation. The implication being he's a workaholic.
Okay.
So he comes in and then they find out that some utilities guys got horribly scalded to death underground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he goes to check it out with his buddy Don Cheadle and another guy. And then the subway guy and the utilities guy are like, nah, this isn't your area because it's bureaucracy.
Right.
And he's like, no, I handle every emergency. I'm Mr. Emergency. And they say no. And it's established that they're probably making the wrong decision because we trust Tommy Lee Jones.
Right.
And
how far are we into the movie now, Kathy? We're pretty far.
10 minutes. Probably. Things come pretty, especially the first half of this movie, events happen pretty fast.
Okay, we'll get to that then. Just keep on rolling then.
And then he and his buddies decide to go down and check out this tunnel where guys got scalded. And there's a lot of fire. There's some sudden flames that they managed to escape from.
Melting shoes, a lot of that.
Yeah, it's getting real hot down there in the tubes underground.
Yeah,
and it's established that this tube is adjacent to a subway tube. And they're like, we shouldn't have trains going through this very hot tube. And the subway man's like, no, I want to keep the trains going through the hot tube. It's fine.
I'm a character actor you've definitely seen before, but you can't quite place
You may have seen me in Fargo as Marge's husband. I was sleeping in a lot of it. Then they come back out and some time passes, like a day, or there's a geologist, Dan Hesh, the geologist comes with her nerdy, cute lesbian girlfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And they consult and they're like, well, maybe there's volcanic shit happening. 'Cause that lake, that pond over there is a lot hotter than it used to be. That seems weird, right?
MacArthur's Park is starting to melt down.
Well, they're starting to just heat up.
Mm-hmm.
And Tommy Lee Jones is like, no, there are no volcanoes here. This is Los Angeles, the town of fire. Wait, yeah. What?
I'm from St. Louis. I know a thing or two about volcanoes.
Yeah, so he's an expert. He's an, mm-hmm. he's a disaster man. Mm-hmm. And then, so they say, no, that's not a big deal. And the night falls, and Anne Hesh and her buddy decide to go down under the ground also. Mm-hmm. And there's another earthquake, and a huge fissure opens up and swallows the nerdy girlfriend, and she dies. And Anne Hesh is very sad.
Mm-hmm. For a little while.
For, yeah, a while, I would think. She probably is probably sad for a while after that, I would think. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seemed like a bummer.
Bit of a bummer.
Anyways, early in the morning, then there's some, like, lava starts spewing out of the La Brea tar pits while Tommy Lee Jones is driving his daughter to somewhere. And they're like, hey, that's probably not normal. Mm-hmm. And then lava starts coming down the street.
So now that we're actually at the lava, I'd like to point out that it takes 30 minutes for a volcano to erupt in the movie Volcano.
Yeah, it's a slow erupt. Well, it takes, like, over the course of a few days.
Yeah, like, a full day of in-movie time passes before, first off, anyone is killed, and secondly...
No, people, the guys are scalded to death pretty early.
Oh, yeah, you're right. Okay, so six guys die, and there's all this stuff about, like, how the one surviving dude holds the key to the whole mystery, but then he is immediately forgotten.
Well, things happen fast enough that they figured it out before he probably, with his awful burns, was able to speak.
And don't forget that while this is erupting, there's also a train stuck in the tunnel with a unnamed driver who is... Mustache Boy, who has, like, two lines of dialogue, maybe?
Well, a couple. He reassures the people on the train a little bit, and he can't get out.
He can't open a door, yeah.
He seemed like a good guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Worth dying for, you might say.
So, yes, it's a slow eruption. It is not an explosive, sudden eruption, as you might have seen in, say, Dante's Peak. It's not what some might call a scientifically accurate volcano eruption.
This is really like the thinking man's Dante's Peak. It's got, like, character and soul and some, like, real consideration about the volcano itself.
It is. And I think, here, I'm going to go into the deep filmic analysis.
Do it.
Because the opening scenes of Volcano are of, like, a bunch of shots of around Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. A lot of them, actually pretty much all of them, depicting conflict between people, between various types of people. Mm-hmm. I might venture so far as to say that the volcano is a metaphor for resentment simmering up from beneath the surface throughout the big city of Los Angeles.
I can definitely see that, but Kathy, I'm going to counter that with that entire bit, that entire aspect of this film felt so horribly stapled onto it.
Sure, but it's there. My point is that it's not just a disaster movie. There is a very, granted, superficial and not super intellectual amount of social commentary happening.
Yeah, so there's a black man who leaves his... Well, there's these protests about the subway. Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of NIMBYs who are like, we can't like have the subway bad. And then people are like, hey, you know, I clean your house. How am I supposed to get to work? So what is interesting about that, of course, is that NIMBYs are wrong. Like, they are morally wrong, but they are scientifically correct in this movie. Because they say it's like, it's because you, in your arrogance, you built this subway to provide affordable affordable transit to our lower income workers that causes this eruption. Damn you.
That's true. Yeah, but I would say it's also there's a conflict between a specific black guy and two white cops.
Yeah, and that was really interesting.
Where he comes to where the police are all gathering to try to sort of stop this lava from advancing down the street. And basically it's like, you know, my neighborhood is burning. Can't you divert anyone over there to help? Mm-hmm. And we are deliberately made to think like the cops that are like basically pushing him aside are being assholes and probably totally racist.
Well, they arrest him for assaulting a fire.
Well, one of them does at
fire,
least.
Yeah, a fireman. And he, of course, has not done that. He's simply saying, like, my community is literally on fire.
Uh-huh.
And so that scene really bothered me because, obviously, bad white cop is in the wrong. But it's also, like, sort of hard to, like, because there's the lava is literally coming at them right now. So the movie establishes stakes that, like, you know, your house on fire... not as important. And, you know, there's a big speech where he's like, you're trying to save museums, but people are dying. But then it's like, yeah, but there's also this lava, which we keep seeing. And that's...
Although yeah. They were, like, I mean, they do make a point of showing them evacuating the Hieronymus Bosch paintings from the art museum.
Which is the only... So maybe this was, like, a thing that I'm just not used to in disaster action movies. That's, like, the only humorous quip in the entire movie.
Well, there's also where the dog... it's the only word play in the movie, really.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the dog thing, like, meant nothing. Like,
well, he made it out. He escaped.
A dog runs away from fire, and that... I mean, they used it to introduce the fact that there's a black community near to the eruption that is literally on fire.
Mm-hmm.
So they arrest him for trying to save his friends and family, and then they eventually cut him loose after he makes reference to Rodney King.
Well, no. They cut him loose because he makes a reference to Rodney King. Also, they're chastised by other people for, like, why are you bothering to arrest this guy? Obviously, there are bigger issues.
Mm-hmm.
And then he comes back and he helps them move the giant concrete barrier thing that they're using to try to...
Because Tommy Lee Jones, emergency man, looks at that lava and is like, this would make a sick swimming pool. I'm going to build a swimming pool full of lava at the end of the street. And everyone's like, what do you mean? He's like, a cul-de-sac. You understand suburbia? And they're like, oh.
Like, I'm from St. Louis, so we have a lot of cul-de-sacs.
That's my... God, that would have been the best.
And he just should have said that.
Best Greek rhetorical bullshit. Like, we have this little thing that we like to call a cul-de-sac. Gonna blow your mind.
And again, we should not try to enforce any kind of science on this movie, because it's by no means scientifically accurate, but I looked up whether or not concrete melts, and it definitely does. It's made primarily out of, like, sand and other rocks.
Yeah.
And yeah. Lava is made of rocks, and if just because you put a concrete barrier up against some lava doesn't mean that the lava will not melt it.
Yeah, and that scene is especially great because they show firefighters standing immediately on the other side.
Yeah, like they would be so concrete. Dead.
Yeah.
And also, none of it's leaking through.
Yeah, and there's like the internal logic of the movie just falls apart because, like, we have seen up to this point, we have seen several people melt just from being, like, near the lava.
Or at least burst into flame.
Well, no, let's not forget the guy from Fargo who heroically, who must have had the best fucking agent, because he's like a tertiary character and somehow...
He gets like the most memorable scene in the movie.
Yeah, he like negotiates that he's going to have this huge change of heart. So instead of being the, up until a certain point in the film, he's the guy who's like, there's no problem here, you're all freaking out too much.
Well, but you would say, I think he's still human because he cares about keeping the subway running, and he cares about the riders of the subway system.
I kind of disagree, because I feel like his whole thing is like, we've got 40,000 customers waiting to go down there, and his first introduction in the film is he's working at, like, he appears to be doing some kind of, like, seismic survey, but what he's actually doing is betting on where the epicenter of the earthquake was with his friends, and he's also, like, shown to be on a nicotine patch, so he's, like, dependent. He's supposed to be weak, and he's supposed to not have, like, the kind of vision that the geologist and Tommy Lee Jones Danger Man have.
Disaster Man.
Yeah, Disaster Man. And yet he somehow negotiates this thing where he's gonna jump into lava to throw a nameless mustache man to safety.
That's character development, though, right there. It's some authentic... And it's okay. And I've also wondered about the scientific accuracy of the melting into lava. And yeah, I'm thinking, you know, first of all, probably the first thing that happens when you jump into lava is your clothes all burst into flame.
Yeah.
It's not just... Oh, my feet are melting, then my shins are melting, then my knees are melting, and he remains standing somehow without feet, and manages, without feet, to throw a human man, an adult human man, a not small-looking human man, several feet.
Yeah, and the bits right up to that are great, where everyone's like, no, leave him, save yourself, don't jump, and then he's like, no, I'm jumping now.
And I'm going to throw him. And also, like, he's walking through a subway car that is actively melting liquid metal around him. Yeah, and he seems, like, to not be, like, blistering or dying at all.
Yeah, and, like, you know, people have up to this point have been like, oh, it's so hot, I can't move. But he's like, I have summoned the strength of my excellent contract that has gotten me this heroic death scene. Like,
It's and great, it, though. Okay, let's pull back a little bit.
It's real bad, Kathy.
Did you not have fun watching this movie?
We should probably keep going because we've only got to Eruption A. There's still Eruption B, and I'm sure the listening audience at home is probably wondering why they blew up that penis building.
Well, I'm sure the listening audience at home largely has seen Volcano before, too.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I sure as shit hadn't seen
it. I certainly think a lot more have seen it than The Name of the Rose.
I don't know about that, Kathy. I don't know about that.
Okay, so yes, the long and short of it is that they somehow managed to, quote-unquote, stop the lava with their barrier and by spraying some water on it.
Yeah.
I don't know how that works.
And there's like a shitload of helicopters with water all of a sudden.
Yeah, well, they called them in earlier.
They mentioned, like, can we get a helicopter? Yes. Turns out there's 30 of them.
No, they bring in the National Guard and they order a helicopter. That's not the biggest plot point, the plot hole in the movie. I wouldn't harp on that because they do actually establish it.
Well, it did bother me because they're not National Guard helicopters. They're just, like, news helicopters, which have been apparently...
No, they're not. They do not depict them as being news helicopters.
They sure do.
They don't!
Have like Channel 9 insignia on the side of them as they fly over.
That's not true.
I mean, you can yell at me all you want, but I watched it like 2 hours ago.
Okay. Anyways, I don't think they make a big deal about news helicopters who happen to have water tanks in the bottom of them.
This is the hill that I am going to die on, Kathy.
Max, let's focus on, if you want to talk about the plot, talk about the plot. If you want to talk about the movie, talk about the movie.
Okay.
Don't bicker about dumb shit.
I love
to. Again, this is a 90s disaster movie, all
right?
Right. This is not, we're not supposed to be like, oh, this really happened. This is history.
Okay. So we've had Eruption A. We fixed it.
Now the volcano decided that it's going to redirect all that volcanic energy through the network of underground tubes,
mm-hmm.
previously mentioned.
Yeah. The subway.
And it's going to meet the point where they have stopped building the subway line, and mm-hmm. then it's going to erupt outwards from there. And by a clever basketball rolling scene, we know the direction of the grade in the city means that it will then flow into some residential areas and destroy the rest of the city.
Mm-hmm.
So Tommy Lee Jones, being a clever guy who sometimes sees buildings in reflections, goes to the location where they expect this lava to punch through and realizes there's a giant uninhabited dong building. That is also, like, right across from the hospital where all of the wounded people are.
And his daughter.
And his daughter is there also. And he decides that within the span of, like, 25 minutes, they manage to set charges to demolish this building and blow up a big chunk of the street.
Yeah, to make a 200-foot-long sluice
mm-hmm.
to redirect the lava.
Into a storm drain where it will safely go to the ocean.
Yeah. Yeah,
and not melt through the sides of the storm drains.
And they make a point. Like, it looks like the concrete is holding, in case you were worried at home.
Don't worry. This is really strong concrete that doesn't melt when lava is in it.
It's going to be even stronger now because it's going to have a lot of rock on it. So it'll be real good when
it'll
we're
be
done.
Fine. It'll be fine.
So spoilers, the lava makes it to the water.
Yeah, but they knock down the very large building in a very short time span.
And there's those two guys that die doing it, that sacrifice their lives nobly, kind of off screen.
So going back to the theme?
Yeah.
If the beginning of the movie is about conflict simmering between people, uh-huh. the lava brings people together and helps us find our underlying humanity and commonality.
You know,
and
I really
culminating in the final scene when everyone's covered by the dust from the demolished building
yeah.
and the small innocent child says, everybody looks the same.
But then it rains and then
we all remember what race we are. Then
races.
We hate each other.
Like, yeah. Also, I was looking at these people all look pretty dramatically different.
Well, but their skin color is the same, which is the important part.
Yeah. Yeah. That is true.
And the volcano resolves racism.
Yep. Well, except what I did think was interesting, that now that you've introduced this metaphor of the volcano as the simmering racism beneath Los Angeles, at the end of the movie, there's some type on the screen, and it says the, like, Mount Wilshire status active, and it shows, like, all this lava spewing out of it. So it's like, you know, sounds like this metaphor for simmering violence is still going strong.
Well, it's probably going to cause white flight. All the people who can afford to will leave Los Angeles because there's an active volcano in it, and only the poor will have to stay.
Oh, So yeah, I think that my I have two beefs. I have two units of beef with this movie. Are you ready?
Yeah.
So it follows the it reminds me a lot of Independence Day because there's too many damn characters and there's just way too much going on. And it's so hard to get screen time for everyone and for like everything to make sense. So that's like my main story beef. And my secondary beef is that I applaud the film for attempting to tackle issues of racial violence in Los Angeles in the mid to late 90s, but it is done so ham-fistedly, so as to almost be laughable and dismissive.
Well, I think you have to take into account the fact this is a 90s summer blockbuster.
True. True.
I mean, even movies that are seen as being, like, prestigious and artsy in tackling race are not great. Like, have you seen Crash? It's a bad movie. It's not even good about racism. But it got an Oscar. Yeah. I think for a summer blockbuster, there at least I've been impressed. And, you know, previous times of watching this, I had not paid a ton of attention to the subtext.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think they do make an admirable effort, and they're not going to hit you over the head with it. Cause again, it's mostly a summer blockbuster. You just want to see people melting. That's why people come to see Volcano.
I will say surprisingly little of that in this movie.
People melting?
Yeah.
Well, there's only one major melting.
Well, two. I mean, she's melted off camera, but.
Oh, you mean the nerdy
girlfriend.
Other geologist. I think she is consumed, engulfed in flame.
Yeah, it's more like some yellow smoke that gets her.
She, in general, is just completely obliterated from existence.
But really, like, way fewer meltings than I expected.
Well, were you satisfied, at least, by the number of meltings?
You know, I don't know, because, like, what I kept coming back to, like I said, was that the only, like, 90s destruction summer blockbuster I'm familiar with is Independence Day, and I kept comparing it to that, where you see
you've seen Twister?
I have never seen Twister all the way through.
You should watch Twister. That's a good movie.
Is Twister better than this?
Again, looking through my modern lens at movies that I really liked and saw a lot as a child,
yeah.
I can't make a good evaluation of whether or not it's a good movie.
Okay.
I can tell you, if you think tornadoes are cool and you're an 8-year-old, probably Twister's really good.
There's a couple things that surprised me about Volcano, and I thought it was, like, really slow. The pacing, I thought, was really weird, that it took so long for the volcano to explode.
I know, the first half was, like, the best part of it.
Really? Oh, I thought that was so dull.
Well, in terms of tension, you get a lot of these scenes where, like, you're people going into underground tubes where at any moment they might be killed by horrible
Yeah, but it's
heat.
All a foregone conclusion, right? Because they're like, oh, we gotta prove that there's a volcano, we gotta investigate this shit, and I'm like, yo, the movie's called Volcano. Like,
okay, Max, when you walk into the movie Alien, do you expect there's going to be an alien in it?
Eventually, maybe.
No, you know there definitely will be. There's almost any movie that's about a concept of some kind of horror or thriller thing. You know there's going to be something.
Okay, how many nude lunches are in The Naked Lunch? That's what I thought. I win.
I don't know if that argument works.
It doesn't. No, I wasn't feeling that tension, I guess, because I was actually getting kind of antsy. I'm like, I really just want that volcano to erupt so that, like, they can, because I think what I wanted to see wasn't the tension. I wanted to see, like, the fun stuff for me was watching, like, Tommy Lee Jones and the rest of his crew, like, try to outthink the volcano mastermind that it is.
You're such a dude.
Yeah.
Like, when you watch movies, you're such a dude.
Well, no, that's not true. I love Alien. Like, my favorite parts of Alien are the beginning of that. I think that's beautiful.
No, but that's because you like spaceships.
I do like spaceships. But
what you want to see is the technical accomplishments or the man overcoming nature. You don't want to see man helpless before nature.
I actually liked the bits where disaster man, Tommy Lee Jones, he has this moment before he realizes that he can blow up the building where he actually says, I don't know. I don't know what to do. And I was grasping because I was like, I don't know what they're going to do either. This is actually a pretty, pretty humbling moment.
Oh, so Volcano really threw a curveball at you.
Volcano. I felt touched by that volcano. I felt like it really got to my soul. I just felt that the beginning was just so all over the place and it didn't really... I felt like I didn't have focus for the movie and I couldn't really feel invested in anyone except Don Cheadle. Anytime Don Cheadle's on screen, I'm right there. Right there with him.
Well, I don't know. I disagree.
That's fair. I was also sort of surprised about the quality of the special effects in this movie. Like, there's some effect shots that are real not great. And there was, like, recycled footage in it, too. Like, from the same movie. Like, they show you the same clip of lava shooting down a tube twice. I was like, wow, that's kind of surprising for, like, a big-budget summer blockbuster.
Well, it was only 1997.
When did Independence Day come out? I don't remember. I'm sorry I keep comparing it to that, but that really is, like, that is actually the only summer blockbuster.
That was the only summer blockbuster you saw as a child?
I didn't even see it as a child.
What? You didn't see Independence Day when it came out?
No, I didn't see it until years later. Oh, wow, Independence Day came out the year before.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that this was that big of a budget. This was not, like, the tentpole summer blockbuster. It came out in, like, April.
That's weird, though. Cause, I mean, that's a good point. I'm just surprised because Independence Day cost, like, $15 million less than Volcano. But I know that these numbers aren't, like, real. I'm surprised. What I'm really surprised now is that this came out after Independence Day, because I felt like it was hitting... I assumed that Independence Day took its cues from movies like Volcano, and that Independence Day was, like, the final evolution of that form, as opposed to...
No. Yeah,
the other way around.
I mean, every year from, like, when Jaws came out until now,
mm-hmm.
there have been essentially the same movies, right? I mean, both of them are smack dab in the middle of the world of summer blockbusters and often disaster movies. Mm-hmm. And that had been going on and has continued to go on. So I don't see it as being having any kind of causal relationship between them.
Okay. That's probably just definitely my experience then of not knowing this genre too well. In hindsight, I should have picked out, if I picked out Volcano at all, I should have picked out Dante's Peak so we could have misplaced bonds up against misplaced bonds.
Dante's Peak is just crap.
Really?
I'm a Volcano Boys.
You're a Volcano Boy?
I'm not part of the Dante's Peak Patrol.
Dante's Peak. That'd be the best fan club name. I really hope that's out there somewhere.
I mean, that definitely is a internet user tremolo joke. I did not write the Dante's Peak Patrol.
just got to meet up every week down at the Dante's Peak Bar and Grill. Talk about Dante's Peak, how much they loved it. So good.
Fuck Dante's Peak. Volcano forever.
So yeah, I guess I was not that impressed with Volcano. I was hoping for some more like crazy antics. I was actually kind of surprised by how much of the film was like Tommy Lee Jones coming up with MacGyver style solutions to a crisis. I guess I was not expecting that.
I don't know, I'm just sort of curious what movie you expected it to be.
I think I was expecting it to be more of a like escape movie where they wouldn't be like actively fighting the effects of the volcano.
You wanted it to be Dante's Peak.
Is that what Dante's Peak is about? Okay. Cause I was expecting this to be more like, oh crap. Like they're stuck in there and they have to like get out. There's like a small group of people trying to like, get away from the disaster.
No, that's not what it is at all.
Yeah. So actually I liked that it wasn't that story. I liked that it mixed that up, but it wasn't what I was expecting in good and bad ways, I guess.
I don't know. I think you need to see it 5 more times.
You think so?
Yep.
I have some extra time today.
I think it's also colored by the fact that you watched it early in the morning on a Saturday.
7 a.m. I got up.
Maybe if you watched it in the evening and or like in a movie theater, you might have a different experience.
Yeah, that's probably true. I mean, maybe if I watch it in like 1997.
Oh, you'd definitely be much more impressed by the special effects in 1997. Because, yeah, they could do a much more realistic and much more, you know, explicit shots of magma in this day and age. I'm not saying they shouldn't remake Volcano. I mean, Tommy Lee Jones is still a working actor.
Yeah.
Volcano 2, it erupts again because we established there's a volcano in the middle of Los Angeles.
I guess I'm just surprised that, like, it doesn't seem to, like, hold up. For me, it doesn't seem to hold up as well as Independence Day, which has a lot of the same problems, but I don't know, I think works better somehow.
Yeah, I mean, I'd probably agree technically Independence Day is a better movie. I mean, mm-hmm. I think it's a very different movie.
Yeah, because the more I think about it, like, that really is, you have a singular intelligence that they're fighting in that one. Like, they have explicit enemies, and this
is... Yeah, it's not man versus nature. Yeah. It's man versus aliens.
Well, let's be clear. This is not man versus nature. This is Tommy Lee Jones versus Volcano.
Well, but Tommy Lee Jones, I think we can... He is the universal dad. He is the eternal dad.
Yeah. Okay.
He represents dadness. Mm-hmm. And it's really dad versus nature.
That's one of the major archetypes, you know, dad versus nature.
It's man versus man, man versus God, man versus nature, man versus aliens, and dad versus nature, which is dad totally different.
And sometimes dad versus aliens, but that's like a micro genre.
Yeah, and it usually falls under man versus aliens.
Definitely, definitely. So I feel like you're disappointed in my reception.
I feel like you didn't give it a chance. I think you looked at it with cynical eyes.
That's probably true.
I think you need to look at it with a child's eyes.
A child's eyes. You know, Kathy, everyone looks the same.
Everyone looks the same. Racism is over. Thanks, Volcano.
Thank you, Volcano. Oh, boy. Alrighty.
All right, time to rate.
Let's do it. Okay, so I think maybe for my unit of measurement, I am tempted to select exploding lava bombs mm-hmm. or possible urban volcanoes as my unit of measurement. But I think I'm going to go with wide-eyed innocent children. So out of five wide-eyed innocent children, I am going to give this. I'm going to give this a 2.5.
Ties.
Yeah, because I find, I did not find Volcano to be as, like, bizarre and enthralling as the Name of the Rose, but...
Comparing it? You should never compare sons. That's dangerous. That can cause horrible injury.
Forgive me. I was never sucked into Volcano.
Okay.
Despite all of the flames and backdraft.
You were never sucked into the lava tubes?
I was never sucked into the lava tubes. Although, like, I really do love the ongoing metaphor of Los Angeles being literally a hellscape. Uh-huh. How many other movies are there where they destroy Los Angeles with fire?
Like a lot.
Escape from L.A.
Wasn't the most recent... or San Andreas, the one with The Rock in it, that was set in California, at least.
Was there fire in that? I don't know.
Well, there was a big wave. I assume there were fires as a part of it, but it was mostly a big earthquake, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm really glad I got to see this, because I feel like I got to know you better in watching
Next,
this.
I think you have to watch Twister.
Yeah, I could do that. Do you want to... We should, you know, for the next one.
Well, I don't think we need to do This Is My Son, because I think it would end up being the same conversation as this one.
Probably.
But I think you should watch it in general.
Sorry, I was clicking through the Wikipedia article about disaster movies, and I saw Airport 77. Like, oh, that's a movie I've heard about, but what I didn't know is that Airport 77 is about a plane that lands on the ocean floor?
What?
It was the 19th highest grossing picture of 1977.
So it doesn't crash. It safely lands on the ocean floor.
Well,
they put down their landing gear and roll to a gentle stop on the ocean floor.
Judging from the poster, it's like on the edge of an underwater cliff, and I'm just like sort of, you know, like scrolling through this here, and it looks like they spend some submarines to help.
How powerful is this airplane that it can stay airtight and watertight and pressurized?
I don't know. Maybe it's like floating on the water, kind of. I
don't think this is a true story.
Oh, this looks... Yeah, probably not. Oh my god, this is like, you know, you took like the airplane movie, and it's like, well, how can we one up like our last airplane movie? It's like, what if?
Airport. Sorry.
Yeah. You think...
Airplane was a parody of Airport.
Is Airport 77 a sequel to... It is!
Yes,
oh my god.
There are a lot of airport movies.
Oh, yeah, because there's Airport 75, and then Airport 79, The Concorde.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Let's watch The Poseidon Adventure. That movie sucks. Okay, that's enough of this. Kathy, thank you as always for broadening my horizons.
Max, what do you want to plug?
I want to plug Brian again, because I've been listening to it a little bit. It's got some good stuff in there. I want to plug this podcast, because I think you're doing God's work.
Show, which you can rate and subscribe to on iTunes, for God's sake, please. And follow us on Twitter at This Is My Son, or go to thisismyson.com. Plug my own self over there on Twitter at MySocks, MySOKS. I'd like to plug the D&D game that hopefully within the next week or so I'll be DMing the first session of, and God, I hope it goes okay. And that's it for me. Thanks everybody for listening. We will see